Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, this is the last episode of the current season before we take a vacation this upcoming week and come back the first week of August. We did a lot of big things this season. We did 30 straight days of episodes on the war in Ukraine. We transitioned to doing 3 episodes a week after that, added discussion episodes, and of course made our biggest addition to the show so far, our Supercast, the way that you can subscribe and support the show monetarily while also getting access to bonus content and features. So if you could support our growth, believe in the show's mission, or just want to get access to our bonus Q&A episodes plus additional interviews, go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. The Substack also comes out today, so you can also check the link in your show notes to get access to that. I'm going to keep publishing my thoughts during this vacation week, so there'll be more content there coming up. This is also a good time to check out our bookshop that features all of the books written by authors that come on the show. It's really great. We get 10% of every sale, and authors and independent bookstores get supported. It's a great way for us to bring good folks onto the show. On to today's season finale episode. I'm speaking with Eve Fairbanks about her new book, The Inheritors, An Intimate Portrait of South Africa's Racial Reckoning. Now, closing on a South Africa episode may seem kind of random, but we're in a way following up on an episode I did with Yasha Munk back in April about diverse democracies in the 21st century, debates over equality, debates over economics, debate over history. All of those ideas are very operationalized in this episode as we're talking about South Africa's evolution since the 1990s. So if you haven't gotten the chance to listen to the Yasha Munk episode, I definitely recommend you check that out right after this. Lots of great things here. I hope you all enjoy this. The season's been a real pleasure, but since I'm taking a week off, I have plenty of time to think about what we do moving forward, topics we want to cover. So definitely write in at realignmentpod@gmo.com, or you could comment or reply to the Substack. Huge thank you, of course, to Lincoln Network, and we'll just once again ask folks who want to support the show, go to realignment.supercast.com to take us into this next season. Here's the conversation. Eve Fairbanks, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you.
I want to start with an area of mutual interest. On your author's bio on your website, you say that as a writer, you love change. Take this question as broadly as you want to take it. The show is called The Realignment. Like, what ways do you see the world, whether it's the world that you're just observing, the world that you're studying through this book? How do you see the world changing right now?
That's such an interesting question, because I sometimes perceive that when I read the news or when I talk to people, there's like a sense that we're both at the edge of an apocalypse, but also in like a very static moment, and that every type of sort of political conflict or fissure or whatever situation, you know, whatever kind of tyrant exists in whatever place, it's going to kind of like continue down that line in a kind of straight trajectory, usually a very dire one, but from like in a straight line from the point that we're at. And I'm sort of interested in that in and of itself, like why we have that view. And, you know, I feel like the reality is so different. So I was born in 1983. My father worked for Reagan. We were a kind of neoconservative family. And he was in the State Department. He was a big opponent of communism. He was a big sort of anti-communist warrior. And I have this very powerful memory. It's just something that you said made me think of it earlier, but of being on vacation when I was 8 in 1991, August 1991, and sitting and watching. We were supposed to be at the beach. I was 8. I just wanted to be in the waves, whatever. And my dad was like, the Soviet Union is collapsing. And I was like, well, so what? We're on vacation. And this was something that for his entire adult life, he had wanted, and he had worked for, and he had fought for. And that was completely how I understood him, as a kind of very sincere opponent of communism and someone who had sacrificed a lot and given a lot of himself to work in the former Soviet republics and to defeat it. And I have this very vivid memory of him sitting in his beach house that we had just rented in South Carolina in front of the TV, watching this coup unfold and basically the very surprising sudden end of the Soviet Union. And this very like ambivalent or almost alarmed kind of look on his face. And it was one of those things when you're really young, where you're right at that age to be like, that is not what I anticipated his face would look like. And because I thought that we would be champagne, I thought we would be celebrating. I thought he would be. He had a lot of friends there who were dissidents. And he was very happy in a kind of intellectual way. But there was this very visceral sense that this kind of unpredicted, at least in the timing, and huge, huge decades upending shift that was occurring, was, I felt like he could see that it was just going to have a lot of knock-on effects that he might not have actually wanted. There was maybe going to be a loss of purpose. There was maybe going to be a confusion in what America's role in the world was going to be after that kind of generations defining tension with the Soviet Union. He looked ambivalent and apprehensive and kind of, and it just, I just remember that. I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that kind of set our fascinations and our interests, but I remember that as being this moment where I just thought, wow, people can want and fight for a certain type of change, and how they feel afterwards is not going to be how they thought they would have felt. And it's, you know, it's going to cause things that are just unpredictable beyond what we could have imagined. So that was just this like seminal moment. I mean, I think it was the age that I happened to be, but on the one hand, it was seeing this visual on TV, this historic change, and yet also having the sense that like nobody had yet really grasped what it was actually going to entail, even people who wanted it so badly, and who were experts and who were policy leaders. And, you know, the other thing is I grew up in Virginia, which is where I am right now, very surrounded by Civil War battlefields, the history of the Civil War, that kind of aura. And in a way, like those things together, that was a thing that felt not finished in also this very weird way, even though it was so ancient. It felt very living. You could walk, you know, my family would take walks on those battlefields, and it was always to me quite eerie. They had a feel of something. There were still murmurs that were kind of unanswered, almost coming from them. You know, we don't have, unlike some other countries, a lot of places to visit where there was a lot of civil unrest or bloodshed at a very large scale on American soil, but those are such places. And I remember having the feeling that I myself and my family and people I knew and the people who taught me history still hadn't fully put together what that war meant, who were its heroes. We're still battling over that. And that was also, I mean, just how long, especially in a time when the internet was starting to kind of blossom, in the sense is that, you know, after 24 or max 48 hours, you ought to know like the truth of a shift that's occurred, something that's happened. And these things were in such tension because, you know, when I left my house, got off the internet, around me were these questions of, you know, I remember finding it amazing that there was academic debate and emotional debate over what people in the American Civil War actually had been fighting for. Mm-hmm. Was it states' rights? Was it some kind of, you know, principles of freedom? Was the North not really fighting to end slavery and didn't really care, but it was an economic thing? So that's a long answer, but I think, you know, we maybe were people who grew up in this wake of like this derided phrase, the end of history, which superficially, I remember in the 90s, people being like, you know, that's so reductive. And yet there kind of was that sense in a kind of unacknowledged way that actually maybe that was true. And a whole lot of types of conflict, types of tribalisms, types of atavisms, types of racial conflict, gender inequities had kind of like were winding to their end. And that now we were just going to like look at this static world. And, you know, one of the sort of pain points and bewilderment points of living right now is like this daily constant sense of like, why did that not happen? Mm-hmm. And why are these things like, you know, Putin's invasion of Ukraine or Orban, whatever it might be, still happening? And even if on an intellectual level, we think, well, that wasn't, even insofar as we understand what Fukuyama meant by that wasn't the right analysis. I think it's like people wake up every day and are like, why is change still occurring? So I try to think about that.
No, it's funny. I did a interview with the Wall Street Journal about long form podcasting, and I was talking about like why I enjoy it. And the fact that you could just give that extended answer is why I enjoy this. This would not work as a 10-minute YouTube or CNN hit, but I think, but it's really important because I wanted to, I'm smiling because I'm just thinking about, because this is kind of the point. Like I want it, like we're going to talk about South Africa, but I think that was a very revealing answer in terms of how you were approaching the specific bit, especially with the, you know, invocation of your father and his reaction as a cold warrior to the end of the Cold War. So in the Inheritors, you're speaking and you're interviewing, you're speaking with folks who were involved in the fight against apartheid. What do you think the equivalent feeling to your father's was in the early 1990s? If you were an activist, a black person, a white person, Afrikaner, who was against the apartheid system, but did you see this change happen and assume, okay, now we're going to have this history moving in the right direction bit? Like how, what was like the equivalent of your father, do you think?
That's such a good question. And I think there is one. So I have lived in South Africa for 13 years. I moved there from Washington in 2009. And in this book that I've written, there are kind of three main characters. They're real, but they're three main sort of figures through which we traverse, it's an academic word, but we, you know, you kind of see the changes, this huge aftermath of white minority rule in South Africa. And one is a man who was drafted into the, a white South African who was drafted into the apartheid army at the end of 1989. So he was effectively like, I think of that John Kerry line of, do you want to be the last person to die for a mistake? Mm-hmm. It's also terrible potentially to be the last person to kill for a mistake. Might be worse in a sense. He was fighting, he was directed to fight for something whose commanders already knew it was ending. Then there's a woman who was born in 1992. She's called a born free. That's like a name for a generation in South Africa. They're not supposed to have memories of apartheid. But the third is a woman who had been a very serious local anti-apartheid fighter. She was a protester. She was jailed many times. She'd been like an organizer to fight this terrible segregationist regime in the 1980s. And you would think that of those three people, or even all the people that kind of emerge in this book, that she would have been the most overwhelmed by joy, excited, anticipatory, thrilled in 1994, the first time she got to vote. She was in her early 20s for Nelson Mandela, a Black president. And it was hard to get her to open up about 1994. I really noticed that she and her friends had a much livelier mean in talking about their protest work. It had been, which had been very like challenging and difficult, but, and she finally said to me, you know, my feelings went flat because when I finally got this moment, which I had barely allowed myself to dream of and that I fought for, because it was already clear in a sense that I think in her case, that less was going to be transfigured than one might imagine when one's thinking of something that you feel is very unlikely to occur, but you dream of. She was going to wake up in the same house with, you know, with the same lack of a vehicle and job. And yeah, she put it in an emotional, and it did remind me of that feeling of my dad's. They were very different causes, but she had a sense of foreboding actually in 1994. And I don't think, you know, I've watched some movies, Invictus and so on, that depict 1994, and it's always depicted as this just euphoric, amazing moment, which it was for many people and which it was in an abstract sense, but there's a lot of ambiguity too.
And something I'm interested in, obviously, aside from just being an interesting story, a lot of folks think of South Africa's story and America's story as being tied together. But I want to really start by focusing on just the differences between South Africa and the United States, because I was thinking, as I was pre-writing questions, I was thinking about that. So I'll go over a few of it come to mind immediately. I'd like to hear you just reflect on them. So number one would be a critical difference when it comes to racial reckoning in the U.S. and then South Africa in 1994, is that it seems like the South African story is just way more straightforward as these things go, in the sense that, for example, because the United States is a country of immigrants in a way that South Africa isn't, there's a whole portion of the country that's even white that wasn't here during slavery. There's a portion of the country that wasn't here, obviously, when the Constitution was signed. There's a whole portion of the country which is thought of as white today, which was not white barely even 100 years ago.
Yeah,
Jews,
right.
Italian Americans, Slavic Americans, on and on and on and on. So there just are those like little nuances, and that's why it gets awkward when you're having this conversation. This is why the 1619 Project conversation, for good or for ill, gets awkward very quickly, because you'll just see a very basic response to people who find themselves on the other end of that project saying, well, my family wasn't here in 1619, and my family was actively discriminated against. From my telling, the story of South Africa seems much more binary, Afrikaner, and just Black South African. Correct me. There's obviously like nuance to that, but that just seems to be the critical, just at a dispositional. Oh, also the difference too is, unlike with slavery, the white people of South Africa today were alive at the end of apartheid. So even if you are the descendant of a slave owner, great-great-grandfather has been dead for over 100 years. So even that is a wrinkle, versus apartheid ended. I was 2 years old at that point. So can you just really get into both the broad strokes, but then the specific details that I kind of missed, obviously?
Yeah. Yeah, the majority of people, I think this is still true. At some point it's not going to be, but the majority of people alive in South Africa today were alive under segregation, which is a huge difference. You know, there is more texture than is sort of sometimes conveyed. So approximately half, give or take, of white South Africans speak Afrikaans as their mother tongue. The rest are descended from English. They're called English South Africans, and they have a slightly more Englishy accent. And there were a lot of, especially in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, a lot of fractures between the English and the the Afrikaners. In fact, there was this war, the Anglo-Boer War, at the turn of the 20th century between effectively like English South Africans, but the British Empire, and then these Afrikaner republics that had modeled themselves on the American Republic, descended from the Dutch. And when I read old newspapers at the time, American newspapers, about that war, they called it a race war, which I thought was fascinating. In other words, between the races of the Afrikaners and the English. The South Africa has the world's largest Indian diaspora. So the most people of Indian heritage outside of India live in South Africa. South Africa, bizarrely, imported slaves during the height of the Atlantic slave trade. And the reason they did that in a reductive way, they imported slaves from Indonesia, from another Dutch colony. So there's a lot of
were they Javans? So they weren't African.
No,
they were dark skinned. I assume.
I think medium. They were Muslim though. In fact, like the first writing in Afrikaans, which is a creole of Dutch, and you know, was a sort of colonial creole, mm-hmm. is actually an Arabic script, and it's the bits of the Quran. And there were a lot of political rabble rousers and serious Muslim imams who were imported in as slaves early on. And one of the reasons that they did that is that it was felt that people who had been like totally severed from their homeland made better slaves. Mm-hmm. And that in fact, like for people, whites in Africa, to use Africans as slaves was problematic. It was so bizarre. So is this incredible diversity, and it's a melting pot. It has this binary feel, though, in part because political movements in the middle of the 20th century, for different reasons, found it useful to make it more binary and to start calling people of, you know, 10 or 11 different tribes all blacks. And to start, to sort of put aside the divisions between the English and the Afrikaners and say, hey, we got to hang together. We're all whites, especially because we're rapidly becoming like less than 20% of the population, which is a huge difference from the US. And so there was that kind of, these divisions became more binary and hard over the course of the 20th century. And I just think, I think that the history of colonialism on the African continent and also the demographics made it a completely absorbing struggle in South Africa, the struggle against racism, mm-hmm. the struggle against this segregationist regime, more absorbing than it ever was in the United States because it was nationalized. And, you know, people may have behaved as though there was Jim Crow in Vermont at many times, but that was, it was in a region. This was all kind of different in regional areas. This was really nationalized, and kind of there was this cross current effect whereby the more overseas opprobrium and criticism white South Africa, apartheid South Africa got, and the more absurd the whole thing started to seem as black South Africans went overseas, got PhDs in economics, mm-hmm. and it became like abundantly clear that they would be theoretically perfectly able to compete with white leaders, the more theorized the white regime had to make everything. They had to put this whole kind of umbrella of theory around it and say, well, exactly these people are white people, and exactly these people are black people, and this is the reason, and that's the reason. You had these bizarre categories, like Chinese people in South Africa were so-called colored, which is a term that's still used for people of mixed racial heritage, but the Japanese were white. Like, it's completely arbitrary. The Greeks had like a battle to be designated white, and it all like in retrospect feels so absurd. But in some way, they had to legalize things. They had to put it into a constitution. They had to codify it more and more. That was what they did as part of their effort to justify it well beyond other African countries winning their liberation from colonialism. So things got very, lines got drawn very starkly in very weird ways, but that also make it a fascinating sort of microcosm or case study for some of these questions of race and reconciliation.
What's so interesting of what you just said is that if it feels binary today, much of that binary status is artificial in construction, right? So you could say today, black versus white, and you could say, okay, that's a fair enough lay reader interpretation of this, but you need to remember that English and then Boer and then Greek, Japanese, but not Chinese, that binary status in and of itself is kind of funny. Like the word social construct, like race is like the phrase, like race is a social construct is like obviously gotten wrapped up in like American culture wars, obviously. But I think this is just the perfect illustration that like, despite those academic-y like culture war fights, you could take a step back and say, no, like actually this is an illustration of that. And I also do think, I want to hear you reflect on this. The story you just told is really an example of why we shouldn't be overly like racially deterministic about how things play out, like even when it comes to the United States, because one of the interesting debates I'm interested in is this increasing debate about what does America look like as it transitions to majority-minority status. However, a point against that thesis that's becoming increasingly clear, I'm doing this from Texas, so this is manifested in my life very specifically. There is a chance, and we're always seeing it happen, that third and fourth generation Hispanics will categorize themselves as white. You know, think of Julian Joaquin Castro, the Castro brothers, congressman, HUD secretary. They didn't even speak Spanish. They had to learn Spanish after they got into elected politics. So it's an example of how that could really switch around. So how does this consistent recategorization as demographics change, as political movements happen, how does that influence how you think about maybe America's future and then South Africa's present?
Such a good question. It made me think of, I'll give you one quick example of, I agree with you in part, you know, that on the one hand, this is totally, totally, totally socially constructed. And South Africa is, you know, if you want to read a prime example of why that happened and how that happened, it's amazing to read about South Africa. On the other hand, it's a tremendous example of how social constructions, to use that term, can over time become real. They can become kind of inscribed into reality. So I took this airplane flight. So at one point, the apartheid government decided to attempt to claim that South Africa was actually separate countries and that there was a white country. And then there were these little black nations, which they called Leboa. They called one the Ciskei. No foreign nation ever diplomatically recognized this, but it was part of a claim that the apartheid government was making that black people, that Africans, that whatever, local indigenous people use the land differently and want to live differently and have a fundamentally different culture and they have different land use. And this, in fact, this claim was made to combat the fact that in the early 20th century, the farmers who were really on the rise were not whites, but they were black farmers in South Africa, and they were rapidly outpacing. So they were trying to kind of like say this thing that wasn't true and was a kind of construction. But the way that the government then resourced these different quote like nations and the way that they divvied the land up means that if you fly in, especially in like a small low flying plane over South Africa, you will still be able to identify visually what land is white and what land is black, because of the patterns of habitation. And those occurred after this kind of construction was put in, really fertile areas tended to be given to the white nation. And so it almost like made real what had begun as a racist proposition, because in fact, like, the black areas produce less. They were more poorly resourced. They were, you know, the parts apportioned for them, blah, blah, blah. And so you get this kind of inscribing into reality, and therefore it can be one of the things that I saw in South Africa was that it can be sort of, it can itself be like a concept and a wishful thinking and an idea to deracialize how we talk about things, because what began as itself a sort of totally stupid construct that had no basis in anything real or genetic or whatever, now like has this reality that has to be faced, that there is a reality to black people being poor and white people, you know, they are different in that way. So anyway, that's,
I want to follow up on that real quick, because I'm glad you went there, because the book is really themed around like a racial reckoning, racial reconciliation, and a debate that you're just in, a debate that's basically been true since the 1960s, not to overstate things, and a debate you're seeing today, and this manifests in different means, is the debate of, is the cause of racial reconciliation and advancement from the past served by being colorblind? Is it served by, I don't want to say ignoring, because that makes it seem like pejorative, but just by just saying like, let's just move on. Content of your character, not the content, you know, not the color of your skin. Because
I mean, there's a case that people make for acting, starting to act like you wish the world was, and then the world will catch up to you. In other words, if you act in a colorblind manner and stop talking about it, then that's one of the ideas that I think you're talking about.
And I guess the question would be, what would the limits of that be in South Africa? So, for example, in the American experience, there's a debate on the left, like the left of the left, around, is the best means of like adjudicating like, you know, racial inequity, just like broad class-based politics, or is it through, you know, specifically discussing about terms in like a racial manner? So like that's the way that debate is manifesting in the US. How does that debate really function in South Africa or at all?
That's such a hard question. I think that I found South Africa refreshing. I use that word with caution because it's a tough place for its residents, and for its citizens. But because they talked much more openly, especially like back in 2009, about they would never really use the word post-racial. I have not heard people use that word because there's a recognition, and obviously, you know, people have a memory of a explicitly white supremacist segregationist regime. So it's closer in time, but there's a real feel for how many assumptions and attitudes still remain in people who even don't mean anything bad by them. There's also a sense there, I mean, I see people acknowledge that they have racist assumptions, both black and white South Africans, that for instance, they assume that a white repairman or handyman or a white policeman is going to be more effective in a certain way than a black one, without that necessarily ever having been true or being true anymore. But for a lot of people, to acknowledge that doesn't seem as dangerous as it does for some people in the US. Whenever I come back, I'm always struck, you know, I was saying something to my mother about, I don't know, a neighborhood we were going to go to in Washington. And I said, you know, I can't believe I've never been to that neighborhood. And I probably have a little bit of a racist view of it. And she said, she was like, oh my God, you know, oh, you're not a racist. Don't ever say that about yourself. Don't think that. That's you. And I was like, it wouldn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise people in South Africa because it was so pervasive, so deep, to acknowledge that this stuff sort of remains. So I think the conversation there can be,
which is healthy. Here's the question: which version is healthier?
Which version is healthier?
Because I this isn't quite my devil's advocate side. This isn't quite what I believe. Is just basically saying that's just you're normalizing. That attitude normalizes not your specific example of DC.
Just
the idea of, oh yeah, like, you know, I kind of have racist thoughts and this or that. That's normalization of things. And we shouldn't normalize antisocial beliefs. What do you think about the healthy side of it?
I thought you were going to go in a different direction. I mean,
where did you think I was going to go?
I thought you were going to go in the direction of, so there are people who, feel that nationally, in terms of like in politics or national discourse in South Africa, that race is too discussed at this stage. Maybe even not so much that too much is blamed on it, but that, you know, and that certain things, for instance, like violence against women, or even at a more basic level, structural economic problems, economic inequality, which has persisted and I believe deepened since the end of apartheid. It has not become a more economically equal country at all. I think that still has something to do with race. I think it's worth talking about race when we talk about that. But there are people who say, like, we just talk about black and white constantly, and it crowds out things that in some sense are like maybe harder to deal with materially. And that's why we talk about this question of, you know, who can we forgive and how do we start getting along and how do we integrate universities? Because if we actually said, well, what do we do about primary schools that suck, or our issues with corruption, or are this incredible economic inequality, we're going to feel it's just going to be too devastating to actually look at that. So I thought that that's what you, yeah.
What do you mean? What do you focus on? That's interesting. I'm curious. Like, what do you think about, let me put it this way. We're obviously, these conversations are happening. South Africa is thinking about this, but let me tell a quick story that I think will resonate with listeners. And I said this to you before the recording started. The way I think most of us in the United States think of South Africa, it's really evolved over the past 30 years. So in the 1990s, it's a like triumph of, once again, like history moving in a Hegelian sense, like history is moving in a positive direction. It's not a coincidence that the Cold War ends, apartheid falls, and the 1990s are great and awesome. Like all these things. And I think there's something to that. These things are tied together. And then in 2010, you know, you've got the World Cup in South Africa. It's time for Africa. Shakira references, all those different bits. And then over the course of the decade, oh, and even in, you know, in 2002, like South Africa's included as part of the BRICS. So, you know, the Goldman Sachs report, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then in certain contexts, South Africa is dropped on the S. So this is one of those advancing stories. But then around, I don't know, like 2014, 2015, 2016, you start to see the American perception or discourse around South Africa change. You start hearing much more about African National Congress corruption. You start hearing more about, let's just say, awkward situations with white farmers for good faith and bad faith. I'll let you give your explanation of what's happening there. Tucker Carlson is doing monologues about the white farmers, and he's portraying it as a, here is a lesson for the United States in terms of like that is his version of Edge of Apocalypse. I'm going to steal that from the start of the episode because that's actually very helpful. So once again, our understanding has changed. it's a caution. People treat it as a caution. I had Yasha Munk on, and you know, talking about diverse democracies in South Africa is colloquially a warning sign for the U.S. So can you just talk about how our American understanding of South Africa has evolved, and what parts you agree with, and what parts do you think are just pure projection in terms of what we're really trying to say about ourselves?
I think there's a ton of projection. I mean, sort of interesting. This I haven't thought through, but let's just drop it out of, maybe it'll be something in, listeners can think about. But, you know, when you have this binary story about politics and story about a people, story about a polity of Black versus white, or even let's say left versus right, but you have it racially in the US to some degree. Somehow that kind of infects discourse where you end up with these very binary views. I mean, I remember being at a really random bar in London, and this like young sommelier with this man bun sort of asked me what I was working on. I was taking some notes to myself, and I said, oh, I'm writing a book on South Africa. And he said, oh, is the ending good or bad? And I was like, there's just so much weirdness actually wrapped up in there, like a country and a place where generations keep going and where people live, it doesn't end. And is it good or bad? Like, I don't know. Do we ask that about France? Is France good or bad? It's interesting that it's a question I think Americans kind of ask of their country all the time. And that is asked of South Africa, but is worth thinking about because I don't think we ask it of everywhere. The other thing is there's so much projection. I mean, I got the sense, and South Africans over time also told me they got the sense that their country was being watched sort of like a rat in a lab in a cage. Mm-hmm. And that lessons were being taken from it that ultimately potentially absolved the observers of responsibility. And this is what I mean by that. If, you know, Mandela was so fantastic, which in most ways he was, and if this incredible thing happened and this sort of miraculous transition, and then it fell apart, that is an absolution of duty for people in diverse democracies to some degree, because it kind of suggests that, like, no matter how much foreign aid you get, no matter how good things seem, at some point it's going to decay, it's going to fall apart. So on some level, doesn't matter what you do that much. The converse also can have that kind of mollifying like effect that, like, well, some of the final stories the New York Times wrote about South Africa in the 1980s were about these sort of power-hungry, violent, toothless Black strongmen. It's quite crazy to read now, sitting in Black townships, kind of going like this and getting ready to like take over and wreak revenge. And one in particular about a Afrikaner farming town, and the mayor proposed a relaxation in laws that would allow people to like walk on the streets in the middle of this town. And they literally tarred and feathered him, like old school.
Yeah.
And then not even 5 years later, you had a Black president, and it, you know, and there's the thing of like, well, if things can be so awful, but then that can happen, then like, this will work out for us. It's cool. I feel sometimes that people, they would like want missives from me from South Africa as a way of comforting themselves a little bit about their own societies. But the country has its own texture. The country, you know, it's worth an examination way, way, way beyond that kind of a line in an analysis of cautionary tales or whatever. So, and it's quite frustrating I think it puts a lot of pressure on a country itself to be in that position, to be in this weird bellwether rat in lab position, because it's trying to get investment. It's trying to get tourists. It is like a wine farm, beaches. It needs tourists. So it's got to play into that too. And it becomes, sometimes South African politics can feel very hamstrung by the need to prove that it's on track B in how I presented them rather than track A.
I think the question then would be America. This is actually, in this last section, we ask some just like conceptual questions. I'm interested in this term, like racial reckoning, and how a society gets to declare it's having one. Because I think a good way of critiquing, not exactly what happened during the summer of 2020, but like at a more meta level, was the establishment. Let's be frank, like the center left establishment, like the, you know, the New York Times, the summer of racial reckoning. That was a declaration. The society didn't come to an accord on there being a need for a racial reckoning. There wasn't. Especially if you look at like the policies that really happened, a lot of the backlash that's really happened. But I think it's fair to say that South Africa did, in the 1990s, actually go through a racial reckoning where you clearly had society at all different levels sorting through these issues. So I'm just curious how you think how organic versus inorganic is a societal reckoning? Is it something that just like, let me put it this way, because I'm trying to like articulate this thing for the first time. Did South Africa like wake up in 1994 and just be like, you know what, like I'm going to talk to my neighbor Eve and we're going to like just talk and we're going to treat each other differently. And those sort of interactions at scale led to a like reconfiguration of racial like feelings in the country? Or did like every aspect of society, from like the principal to the president to the head of the army, say, we are going to do this thing and we're going to readjust the ownership of farms. We are going to change this law regarding it. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that they did, but wake up and say, I'm going to have to talk to my neighbor, but not necessarily by choice. The physical segregation was so extreme. I mean, interracial sex and marriage was illegal in the 80s and heavily policed. I have a friend whose parents were both doctors, but in the 80s, they were not allowed to dissect white dead people. There was a real extremity to the physical separation. You had to have a pass as a Black person to walk in white neighborhoods. And somebody told me that growing up in the 70s and early 80s, he had thought as a white person that South Africa was about 80% white because of what he saw. Mm-hmm. And it was actually the opposite. And so when those physical barriers, when that physical segregation fell, I mean, you just had, if, you know, people could now apply to universities, people could, so there was this, by necessity, very rapid, very, very rapid and sudden integration. And people were enthusiastic. There was that fall of the Berlin Wall, 90s, you know, okay, we're going to start something really different. So we're going to actually work hard to get a lot of Black students at our formerly white university. Like, we're going to go for it. And there was a kind of positivity around it because it was recognized. There were a lot of white writers in South Africa who wrote about how corrosive segregation was to the white soul, if one could put it that way. And so there were those efforts. It was both conscious and kind of like a wall falling. I think it's a really different situation in the US because demographically and in terms of the speed of things and it was not possible, not to notice that this was happening or feel like you had to be part of it, even if maybe you didn't like it, but in South Africa, because it was a wave.
The way I'm thinking as you're talking is that it's speed running, reconstruction, the Jim Crow South, and the post 1965
totally
moment
speed running it.
in a 10-year period.
And I kind of wish it's kind of, I don't know. I haven't thought through it a ton, exactly how you're putting it, but there's a way that I wish that we had speed run it. You know, I have this conversation with my father, who's like a kind of old school Republican. And he says a thing that can often be derided, but is a kind of classic conservative thing, which is that it can be important for change not to happen too fast. I mean, even behind the scenes, like progressives will sometimes say, you know, this can't kind of, it's going to be, there's going to be a backlash. That's a lot of something people were saying a lot about Roe, is that like this whole thing, you know, it would have been okay. If people had been able to dip their toes in more and like gradually, you know, get used to this new situation. It was done state by state. I've seen a couple of articles about comparing it to gay marriage, which was kind of done quickly, but sort of state by state, and that, mm-hmm. and that this was the mistake, was to just do it super fast. I don't really buy that. I think that's a counterfactual. And it's hard to exactly compare South Africa, but it's interesting to read about, because you see how just jumping into the deep end and basically like people literally went to sleep in one type of a racial situation and a type of society in April of 1994. And they woke up in a totally different one, and they saw things different around them in like 24 hours. I mean, some stuff took longer. And I kind of envy that at times. I think there's a benefit to that.
That's just so interesting, because the obvious way to think about this, what you're essentially saying is, you know, what if the Reconstruction Project, but not even the Reconstruction Project, I guess basically it's basically like, what if the 20 to 30 years after the Civil War had gone one direction? And I think I could see two sides. You could see two sides of it. You could talk about the backlash. I think the thing that you kind of want to push your father on, I'm not being here, of course, is basically this idea of so much of the post-Civil War backlash against like people of color in America was, it developed the same period. So like Jim Crow wasn't the law in 1865. Jim Crow effectively, it's like with a lot of the Confederate statues. A lot of those Confederate statues went up in the 1910s and 1920s. Like that's why my position is, I think it's insane to remove like Thomas Jefferson, a statue of him, for 15 different reasons.
Yeah.
But a statue that was put up in 1910 directly meant to support the Jim Crow South as Woodrow Wilson is segregating the federal government, I'm like, oh yeah, open season on that one. So those statues evolved in that non-sped run process. And maybe, and I guess this is really the test for South Africa, to your point of like the lab rat part, because then I'll get to my last question here. The test for South Africa is, doing this quickly is obviously going to cause a lot of instability. I suspect in America that had continued the Reconstructionist project for another 10, 20, 30 years would have been much more unstable, obviously, right? Like the 1880s, 1890s, the big political issue was civil service reform. That is not true in a society where we didn't move on, quote unquote, in 1877. So the test for South Africa, and I think this is the useful way to think of South Africa, is basically, does forcing and confronting the issue in this manner pay off in the long run? And I don't want to make it seem like it's a gamble and like it's a game because it's people's lives, but I guess that's what I'm basically reacting to when you're putting it this way.
Hmm. You know, there's layers of the issue. So in my book, you know, people can read, there's two different depictions of two different universities, which are treated a little bit like institutions, like microcosms of even government or a country as a whole. There, I think there's a lot of limitations to that, but that's, and one of them integrates virtually instantaneously, and another goes more slowly. The first one is an Afrikaans one, and it's, I spend more time describing it. And, you know, the funny thing is that they both kind of ended up having the same blowback and the same conflict and the same problem. It didn't matter, actually, that, you know, they really agonized over whether to do this very rapidly and get Black and white people in dorms together as roommates immediately. And like, this was going to make this huge difference. And they kind of just both ended up with the same issues to confront. And the other thing is that there's almost these two waves of integration or kind of racial reckoning, so to speak, in South Africa. And the first is ensuring equality and equality of opportunity, even maybe equality in some cases of outcome. I mean, that's a debate there. But ensuring that Black people are allowed to enter the same universities as whites, get the same types of jobs, live in the same places, that there's liberation in that sense and not segregation. There's this much sort of deeper second level, which is also, is the country that white South Africans created actually, like, is it a worthy inheritance? Like, is it a good inheritance? Is it, you know, so we can, Black South Africans can become president of that system, that economy, can become kind of mind leaders, whatever, can enter the top of it. But then you have this second, more intense almost moment where it's this question of like, is it really a good place? And is it, was it set up, was it constructed constitutionally? They got a new constitution in 94, but there was a lot that was held over economically and so on. Is it possible to have the society that ultimately we think would make people flourish and we think would be great and we think, you know, make people happy? If you were just, let's say, even say you replaced every white person with a Black person in South Africa, it could still be unjust. It could still be oddly racist in ways that I describe in my book, and it could suck as a place potentially. And that's like a much more confronting kind of question. And one that I think like in the US is starting to be nuzzled up against or played with a little bit, which is like, even if we do get almost maximal kind of equality of opportunity and freedom, like, do we have a just society? How important is that to us? Was that our hope at the beginning? And these are questions that, especially in South Africa, they do have to do with race, because that was present from the very beginning, that type of sort of differentiation. And do you expect to have a group of people who are willing to work for you with no labor protections and for almost no wages? And why do you expect that? And would you expect that of people who looked like you? And even in a country run completely by Black people, do we still expect that? So, you know, you get this second order of questions that, I don't know how those can be dealt with quickly, because they're much more complex. I don't know if I've described it in a way that's sort of comprehensible, but yeah.
Well, no, it's no, and this is interesting because it's almost kind of like it's an overused word now, but it's almost like a vibe. It's not going to be particularly, it's not going to perfectly resonate. So I think for the last question, I want to go back to your usage of the phrase once again, like edge of apocalypse. It feels like what America and South Africa have in common is that in a bunch of different categories, the way I'll articulate Edge of Apocalypse, it's really pick your poison, pick your issue. It's not as if like the country, the project, the idea breaks apart tomorrow. It's just that like, hey, if we don't handle climate change the right way, in 20 years, my Austin vibe is ruined. Hey, if like we don't properly make democracy responsive in 20 or 30 years, this or that could happen. So yeah, I don't think anyone in South Africa is saying, oh, like it's over, it's ruined tomorrow. It's like this 10, 20, 30 year thing. So how optimistic are you that societies faced with this sort of problems, these sort of like Edge of Apocalypse problems, can handle them?
I have a sort of view that I think doesn't feel very popular when I sort of say it, which is that I think there's a mindset question that's partly at play. Something that I almost raise in the book, and not only to South Africans, but to listeners wherever, or I mean readers wherever, but what use is it to you to both believe and feel that you're at the edge of an apocalypse? Is it possible that you want to feel that way?
The answer is a lot of people do.
Like, I know, but I think for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah.
and it's easier. It's a little, I mean, there's an example in the book, if people read it, I won't go into it, it's the last question, but the way that certain South Africans have become hesitant to use the legal system because they believe that it's broken. And it is in some way is dysfunctional. So this is small claims court, larger court systems, et cetera. They don't believe that they believe judges are biased, that paperwork will get a whole host of things. So in the situation on my street where instead of dealing with an abandoned property in a legal manner, people said, well, let's just put in some Congolese gangsters and they'll just defend it with guns because and we'll pay them because the law doesn't work. I really came to realize, and I described this a little bit, but that if people were not using the law, if they were not using the courts stopped working more. The courts that it was a two-way street. It was a chicken and egg. It was I think that there's a lot of reasons for citizens to distrust their government and have a lot of fear about the future. But it's also true that if citizens don't have some kind of faith in a system, that itself can degrade those systems and become a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. So I don't have like predictions or, you know, how likely do I think it is 30 years from now that, you know, South Africa will still be a functioning country on various metrics. I'm not really sure. It's got a lot of really, 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 really hard, like kind of like math insoluble kind of structural problems. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there's a much huger role than is sometimes acknowledged for a populace. How much faith do they have? How much faith are they willing to have in a place? And that's gonna set trajectories to some degree. It can sound a little woo-woo, like y'all need to believe in your country. But there's like a reality that I see in South Africa that's quite stark to that.
Yeah, and the way to close this is, I'm struggling to think of a historical example where a feeling of doom has served anyone particularly well at this level. Cause it's not actually, cause this is your point with the court story. It's not actually like, okay, so we give up on the legal system. What do you possibly do with that? At that point. So no, that's not woo woo. I think it's actually sometimes the unsexy answer is that straightforward things can be true sometimes. Right. Especially when it comes to small claims court. Eve, this has been really great, really helpful. The book is out now, and really recommend folks check it out. It's available in our bookshop and all those other great places. Thanks for coming on The Realignment.
Thanks so much for asking me, Marshall. It's great to talk about it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.